to travel and to have adventure and experience and challenges, and the more that's thrown at you, certainly for me, the more I kind of hate it at the time, but secretly really quite enjoy it. So like it's sort of sadomasochist slightly, I suppose. I sit and wonder every time I go somewhere. I sit and wonder of the culture and the food and the people and the humor and the fun that you can have in all these countries. And that's what's really I've learned. So I'm always happy to go anywhere. Still, that still turns me on.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
Adventurer, motorbike enthusiast, travel writer, and TV presenter. My guest in this episode is a man that has provided highly valued nuggets of inspiration for me in different phases of my life. More on that later on. I'm talking about Charlie Borman, a charismatic guy that has explored the world for the past few decades with a sympathetic let's do it mentality that has won him quite a following on TV and social media. He started out as an actor, being the son of the famous director John Borman. In 1997, however, on a film shoot, Charlie met actor Ewan McGregor, known from Star Wars, Moulin Rouge, Trainspotting, Dr. Sleep, and many other films. And they became close friends. One of the things they shared was their love for motorbikes. And eventually, they set off to a great adventure together, going around the world from London to New York via the long way, via Europe and Asia. This trip has been turned into a best-selling book and a hugely successful, I would even say iconic, TV series named The Long Way Round. After that, Charlie did TV shows like Race to Dakar, By Any Means, Ride to the Edge, and Charlie Borman's Extreme Frontiers. Charlie and me, we talk about The Long Way Around and some other trips of his, and I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Let's go. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, it is my pleasure.
Yeah, I will be a bit impolite this time and start this interview by talking about me for a second.
Okay.
So, when I was a child, I loved all kinds of adventure stories. For example, books by Jack London or Jules Verne or James Fenimore Cooper or any of the old explorers. So, basically anything that dealt with exotic, unknown places or the wild in general. And the same applied for movies. I loved movies on the gold rush and men's fight against nature. And one of the movies that impressed me when I was really young was a film of the name The Emerald Forest. And many years later, I watched one of your TV shows, The Long Way Around. And I have to admit it, back then I didn't know who you were, so I Googled you. And I was surprised that the motorcycling adventure guy that inspired me with his motorbike trip around the world in this case was the same guy that had inspired me many years before in the Emerald Forest. So all of this is my long-winded way to give reason for being a bit selfish and to ask you to talk a bit about that movie. So what was it about and what do you remember about shooting it?
Oh, gosh. Well, it was only a
long time
ago. Yeah, it was only a couple of years ago.
Yes.
I think I was 16 or 17 at the time. And I grew up in the film industry. My father is a film director. He directed films. He directed The Emerald Forest, and he directed films like Deliverance and Point Blank and Excalibur, Hope and Glory, lots of big Hollywood movies. And we as children, you know, I was on a plane at 3 months old flying to Los Angeles while my father made a movie with Lee Marvin in the South Pacific. And so I think as a family, we traveled a lot. And in different places and lived there for a long time while my father made the movies. And I think a lot of that is to do with why I travel so much now. You know, I think a lot of it is to do with my father. He was a big adventure movie maker. You know, the more difficult the movie, you know, the better for him it was. You know, for instance, you know, Deliverance and the Emerald Forest. You know, this was set in the jungle in Brazil. It was based on a true story about a man who had gone to Brazil to be an engineer and to build a huge a huge project. And in our movie, it was a giant dam. And when he first arrived there, he was out on the edge of the jungle with his family, a little girl and his wife, and this little boy. And while they were having the picnic, the boy wandered into the jungle and was taken by Indians. And the father didn't know this, but he searched for his son, couldn't find him, and then spent the next 10 years, every moment he had, to look for his son. And he found his son in the end, and realized that his son was an integrated part of this tribe, and there was no point in bringing him home. And then a big disaster happened, and his father had to go back and help. And that was the true story. And so my father made this film, The Emerald Forest, and I played that little boy being, you know, older when he was 16, 17 years old. And we had this huge adventure on screen and while making it as well. I mean, it was pretty hardcore, extreme place to make a movie.
And how far did this scenario of a young boy being, if you will, lost in the jungle and then being confronted with our civilization years later, and how far did that speak to you?
Well, I think, you know, it was always an interesting story, and true stories are always interesting. I think one of the things that we tackled, and this was back in 1984, was that we were tackling the environment at the time and how mankind was coming in and just cutting the jungle down. And there's always a very famous line in that my father put in, and it was the sort of the Indian chief, which was my sort of, I suppose, my jungle father in the film. He said, he looks out at this earth that's been ravaged and ripped off. And he says that they're taking the skin of the earth, you know, how will she breathe? And that was back in 1984. And back then they were cutting down vast areas of jungle even then. And they haven't really stopped since then either. So I suppose the movie was a little ahead of its time. The movie did really well in the end, and you know, it shone light onto what was going on in Brazil at the time. But you know, my father always said he felt that it was a little bit too early. It was too ahead of its time, really.
Yes, it feels quite timely now, right?
Yeah, I mean,
exactly this topic, the balance between development or progress and nature,
yeah.
As in this case, partly opposing forces.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, progress is winning, really. Yeah. Nature seems to be getting absolutely fucked at the moment. But it is, it's a very difficult subject now, really. You know, we look at, you know, at any one time, you know, there are over a million people in airplanes 365 days of the year. We're flying around all over the place. We're not being very generous to our world. And, you know, I suppose at some stage something has to change. I mean, and that's a kind of contradictory really to yourself and myself, is that we both love to travel and to have adventure and experience and challenges and, you know, the more that's thrown at you, certainly for me, the more I kind of hate it at the time, but secretly really quite enjoy it. So like it's sort of sadomasochist slightly, I suppose, you know.
And especially when looking back to it, yes.
Yeah. And we all, you know, if we go on holiday or if we go anywhere we go, you know, we don't remember the bits of lying on the beach and having pina colada. You know, we remember getting to the beach when we had the flat tire and we, you know, we got the spare tire and the spare tire wasn't right. And we had this whole adventure just changing the tire. That's the bit you remember.
How do you wrestle with this contradiction yourself? You just hinted at it, that you and me, we of course love traveling, we love adventures, but very often this, for example, you talked about flying, this involves flying.
Yeah, it does. And you know, I think you have to look at it and, you know, in all the adventures that I do, I try to, you know, certainly more recently try to sort of offset everything, try to, you know, luckily I travel overland and stuff like that. So my footprint isn't as bad. I mean, it's still bad, but you know, I try to do, as much as I can to offset it all. I try to highlight problems and things that are going on and how we can help within the shows. Like in Long Way Round and Long Way Down, we do a lot of work with UNICEF. We try to highlight all sorts of things that are going on around the world. And I think if all of us do our little bit, we can make a difference. You know, rather than buying Argentinian beef or New Zealand lamb, let's buy you live in Germany, buy German meat. You know, I should be buying British meat. You know, so we should all be looking to shop local whenever we can. You know, I mean, you guys in Germany are far better at recycling and all this thing than we are. I mean, we're stone age in this country when it comes to recycling and everything. I mean, it's embarrassing.
I will try to do a very, very bad transition off from recycling to motorcycling, because this is, of course, the way
We're going down a very heavy way. You know, I don't want to talk about that. Nah. You know, that's our children and our children's children's problem.
Yeah, let's talk about it later. No, it's a very good way to start the subject, because as you said, you do travel a lot overland. And one way you do that, or the main way, I would say, is by motorbike. So how did you, for the very first time, get interested in that? Was the foundation for this also laid in your childhood?
I grew up in the countryside. We moved to Ireland when I was about 3 years old. And we went over there. My father was editing the movie Deliverance, because there wasn't any editing suites in London. They were all full. So we went to Dublin. And while we were there, my father fell in love with this property and bought it. And so that's where we ended up there. So if we weren't in somewhere around the world making a movie, we were living in Ireland in the middle of the countryside, up in the Wicklow Mountains. And we had land, and there was lots of land around us. And we used to have horses when I was young, and I used to love riding horses and go off for hours on riding horses. And then this friend of mine, a guy called Tommy Rochford, he had a motorbike. It was a German bike, actually. It was I think it's German, or was it Italian? I can't remember. And it was a Mako 400. And I kept hearing it, you know, this two-stroke engine. And eventually I found him, or had the nerve to go up and say hello. And I was a tiny, I was only 7 or 8 years old. And I asked if he would give me a go on his motorbike. And I sat on the bike and I couldn't touch the foot pegs. I was too small. So he put it in first gear and he just pushed me off. And I rode around this field until I fell off. And that was it. I was obsessed with motorbikes ever since. And then I realized that if I rode a motorbike, I didn't have to clean it. I didn't have to feed it. I didn't have to muck out the stables. I didn't have to clean the tack. I could ride all day long and then just lean it up against a wall and go in, you know. So I was hooked forever. And that's kind of how motorbikes started for me. And I you know, if I look back on it now, you think, God, I had no idea that would completely and utterly rule my life. You know?
Yeah, because for many years, acting ruled your life. How did both your passion for motorbikes and traveling and your acting career, how did that develop in the following years as you grew up?
I think for the acting was that kind of, because I was always on film sets. There was four children, three girls and a boy. And whenever they needed a kid in the movie, he would say, oh, listen, we won't pay for a child. We'll just use one of my kids for free. You know, nowadays you just wouldn't be allowed to do that nowadays. That would just be child labor. That would just wouldn't, you know. So we were just always in dad's movies and you know, whenever it was. And I kind of fell into acting. And I wasn't very good at school. I'm very dyslexic. So I find it difficult to read and spell. And so I was never going to be an academic. And I started doing more and more movies and really enjoyed acting. I could express myself, you know, where I couldn't in school. And so my father kind of encouraged it, really. He thought, you know, this is the direction that you should go in. And so that was kind of where I went. And I was in a few of his movies and did quite well. And then I ended up doing more and more movies. And then I used to always find it so stressful to learn how to learn lines. Being dyslexic, I just found it such a stress. I hated it. And so slowly I started doing less and less acting.
And you also started to choose your films based on different priorities, right? Not focusing only on the script.
Oh God, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I think partly the reason why my acting career kind of really wasn't working out so well was because I kept choosing scripts for their locations. And someone said, oh God, there's this film in Africa. Do you want to come? I go, yeah. And then I would be sitting on the plane reading the script and thinking, well, that's shit. And so, you know, I'm thinking, oh God, what have I done? But I'm in Africa, you know. And so that was that. So I think it was partly my choices of movies, you know, which weren't very good, and being dyslexic and just struggling to learn. And so that kind of slowly phased out. And then I ended up, you know, like lots of actors do, I ended up painting people's houses and doing that kind of thing. And then that, I got less and less movies, and then that turned into more and more building work. And then I started doing people's houses up. And then I did that for about 10 years, and I was doing that more than I was acting. And I was thinking, shit, my dream is, I might be over. And then I got a phone call one day from a friend who I'd made a movie with before. I'd worked with him on a number of movies, a guy called Philippe Rousselot. He was a lighting cameraman. He worked with nearly all of my dad's movies, and we were great friends. And he said, look, I'm directing this movie called The Serpent's Kiss. Do you want to be in it? And I said, yeah, sure. And there was Ewan McGregor, Pete Postlethwaite, Greta Scacchi, Richard E. Grant. You know, it was a big cast of people. And I thought, this is my comeback movie. Anyway, the movie turned out to be pretty shit. But I ended up meeting Ewan McGregor. And we ended up having this fantastic relationship. And it was all about motorbikes. That's all we ever spoke about. We rode motorbikes together. We talked about motorbikes. We ran a motorbike race team together for a while. We went on track days. We just anything to do with motorbikes. We just did it. And then one day we thought we came up with this idea, you know, about doing a longer journey. You know, let's do something longer. And so we thought of doing that. And then we thought of riding to Spain. And meeting our family in Spain. And then one day I remember Ewan rang me up and he said, Charlie, I've got this great idea. I think you should come over. So I came over and he had this big world map out and he said, look, let's, why don't we ride from here to China? And I thought, okay, that sounds good. And then we started working on that. And then someone mentioned about the Road of Bones in Russia. And we thought, God, that would be amazing. Go through Mongolia to get to Russia from China. And then Ewan said, well, you know, if we're going to go there, well, we may as well go to New York. And we thought, okay, well, let's do that. And then our wife said, well, you know, how long is that going to take? And we said, I don't know, about 4 months. And strangely enough, they both said, okay, straight away. So I don't know if they just wanted to get rid of us or I have no idea, but anyway, so that's where it kind of started, this adventure. And that was my career change. You know, I was struggling. I mean, bills were starting to catch up with me. I had two children. I had a mortgage. I was working all hours just to get going, you know, and things were really starting to struggle. You know, I was going to the petrol station and I was putting, you know, 10 euros at a time in because I couldn't afford to fill the car up and you know, bills and, oh my God, it was really, wasn't great. So Long Way Round came at the perfect time.
Did you directly, when he made the suggestion, understand that this might help you also with your professional and financial troubles? Or did you do the idea and did you like the idea despite your challenging situation?
I think, we had no idea. I mean, I was just trying to think of a way to be able to fund it because I didn't have any money. So, you know, and someone said to us, oh, why don't you write a book about it? You know, you might get some money. And we thought, oh, okay. And then we got our agent to approach some people with the books. And the book people thought it was a really good idea. You know, two friends going off, not knowing what happens, you know, an adventure. And they thought that, you know, was a good idea. So the book people were interested. And then, you know, we thought, okay, we're going to write a book. But then I'm dyslexic and Ewan's not a great writer either. You know, and we both have great ideas, but, you know, we thought, how are we going to do it?
And I think you just really started to think about that after you actually signed the deal, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Got the money first, then just worry about it afterwards. I mean, isn't that what everybody does? Just, you know, grab the money and then think, fuck it, I'll just do whatever I have to do, you know? So we sort of did that. And then we thought we would, you know, do video diaries about our feelings, about everything every day. And then we could transcribe those. And then we got a guy to help us to, because we knew exactly what we wanted to do with the book, but just getting it done was the problem. So we created this whole idea. We got this guy to help us to structure this book. And then we thought, well, actually, you know, if we're going to do these video diaries, let's film a bit. And then that just went stupid after that. Then we got these Russ and Dave, our producers involved. We met them. I'd met Russ at some random party that it was a flat warming party that I'd done his flat up, and he had a lot of friends around, and he had invited me along to celebrate the house, or the flat being finished. And I met this guy, Russ, and he'd made some documentaries about bikes and, you know, and then eventually I kind of got hold of him. And then I said, look, I'm going to come over to your office with Ewan McGregor and we're going to talk about it. And he put the phone down and thought, well, bullshit, that's never going to happen. He doesn't know Ewan McGregor. And then I had to cancel like two times because Ewan was making Big Fish and it was running over. And eventually we came along, and then we parked the bikes on the pavement, and Russ was looking down, and he saw Ewan took his helmet off, and he saw that it was Ewan, and he ran back into the office and said, right, everyone look busy. It really is Ewan. And so he, you know, so when I came in, it was like, we came in and there was this big hive of busyness, you know, and he sat down and he became clear that he was the right guy, you know, and then it went on from there, and we managed to get a TV deal. And that was really hard to get the TV deal. It was really difficult. And we thought it'd be easy having Ewan McGregor, a big film star and stuff like that, but it was tough. The book was easy, but the TV show, because we kept saying to people, yeah, no, we're going to go and do this, but we don't really know what's going to happen, you yes. know? And so for a book, that's fantastic. But for a TV show, it's like, well, you know, something has to happen. And go, yeah, no, I'm sure something will happen, but I just don't know. And so they were very skeptical about that.
They really wanted to have a storyline.
Yeah, they want to have a storyline. And I remember one time we went to America to try and get some money over there. And one TV station said, yeah, well, look, you know, that's a great idea, Charlie. And Ewan think that's fantastic, but you know, we think it should be more kind of have more jeopardy, and I think that, you know, we could get the audience to vote as to who gets voted off and all this kind of stuff. And I was thinking, well, they're not going to vote Ewan off, you know, so I could quickly see myself disappearing from the TV show, and Ewan was going, I quite like them, and I'm going, no, they were terrible. What are you talking about? But anyway, we kind of ended up finding the right bunch of people who kind of believed in the story.
And you also ended up with a camera guy that was quite a funny character, right?
Mm. It was very difficult because we were, you know, again, we just signed the bit of paper and we had no idea how to make it or film it, or, you know, how do you film two guys riding around the world without looking like you've got 10 trucks behind you and you know, all this kind of stuff? You know, how do you do it? I mean, when we first did it, there were no GoPros. There was nothing like that. It was just a HD video camera and these big cameras, you know, these big cameras. There weren't all these little 4K, 5K cameras that you have now, and GoPros and Garmin Pros and whatever you want. You know, there just wasn't any of that around. So we had to invent all of that. And then we were thinking we wanted a third cameraman on a bike that could just travel with us. So it could just be the three of us, because, you know, you can't be invited to stay in someone's house if there's six of you or seven of you. But if there's three of you on motorbikes, it's possible, you know? So we're looking at all sorts of people. And then Russ said, I've got to find this guy. I found this guy, Claudio von Planta. He's just Switzerdeutsch. And he came in and he was a one man band and he was amazing, you know, and he answered all the problems and he rode a motorbike. Well, at least he said he rode a motorbike. Well, he did ride a motorbike, but it turns out that he just lied as well, like we all did, and lied and just said, yeah, no, I have a license. Yes, I have a license. Yes. And he didn't. And then he failed his license, his test three times, and then finally got it. I mean, it was if anybody wants to go and see this, some people might have seen it and some people haven't yet, but you know, you should see at least the first two episodes, because there's just chaos. In the first, it's just four idiots not knowing what the fuck they're doing. They really have no idea, you know, and because no one had done it before. You know, that whole idea of kind of adventure travel and filming it really kind of hadn't really been done in that way before. So intimate.
Did that lack of driving experience lead to any awkward situations or challenges along the trip?
He was useless. Well, no, he was great. Actually, that's not fair. He was brilliant. He could ride a bike. But I've done like five TV shows with him now, and his riding ability has never really changed. You know? And he doesn't really care. You know, he just rides along and he stops when he wants to. He gets up and films when he wants to. If you say to him, you got to leave at 9, he won't be ready till 10. So you just lie to him and you say, oh, we're leaving at 7:30 and we might get away by 9, you know, and he just does his own thing. I mean, he's a count, you know, so he's a Count Claudio von Planta. Oh my gosh. He is brilliant. There's no one else in the world who can do what he can do, is ride a motorbike all day. And every single time you get off the bike, he films you. There's just no one like him.
So what was the eventual trip like when you finally got it off the ground? I mean, I know it was quite a few years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time
ago. So looking back after all these years, is there something that still stands out for you when you look back?
Well, you know, since then we did Long Way Down, and yes. I did the Dakar Rally and made a TV show called Race to Dakar, and then did a whole ton of other TV shows, which I did most of them with Claudio, and all because of Ewan, really, because if it wasn't for him and his enthusiasm and his desire to want to do it, you know, we'd never have got it made. And you know, I can truly say that, you know, Long Way Around and everything that's come of it changed my life and gave me a life, a totally different life. I can now fill up my car with fuel to the top. I can pay my bills without worrying about waiting for as long as possible. It's changed everything for me, and it's giving me a new career, a new life that I thought my entertaining years were over, you know, so it was huge for me.
How was it? I mean, we don't have the time to go into great detail because people can watch the actual series still, yeah. And they should. What did it feel like for you to eventually, after all these months traveling on 2 tires around the world, what did it feel like to eventually ride over a bridge into New York after all of that?
My God, it was, you know, for us going through Far East Russia, you know, Magadan and Mongolia and Siberia and Far East Russia and on the Road of Bones. And I mean, that was like pure adventure. I mean, we had to put our bikes on these huge Ural 4-wheel drive trucks just to get across river after river after river. And we had to build ramps in to get into the river and cut away the road just to get the trucks in. And sometimes we'd had to put the truck down and then you'd ride the motorbike across with the truck protecting you so that you didn't get washed away by the river. I mean, it was real adventure. It was everything we'd looked for the TV, you know, for us, never mind the TV show, you know, it was just adventure. And then, you know, finally getting into Alaska and then going through America and then, you know, riding into New York and going across that bridge, it was monumental. You know, we were sitting on these motorbikes. We'd left essentially our home in London, and we rode, apart from going on the train in under the tunnel, and we got a short plane from Magadan to Alaska. The rest of it, we rode all the way to New York, and it was incredible to see, just incredible. I mean, it was so emotional.
Beyond the career and the professional opportunities that resulted from that, did this experience, I don't want to be that pathetic to ask you if it changed your life personally, but did it change your priorities in life?
Well, it certainly changed my life. I mean, I left London on that trip with 3,000 euros in the bank and a mortgage and my wife and 2 young children. And then when we finished and the TV show came out, everything changed, you know, everything. And, you know, I suppose the biggest thing that I got from it was that, you know, although people, you know, everybody always, you know, you say to people, I'm going to Africa or I'm going to Russia or I'm going to Iran or wherever it is. And people go, that's a dangerous place. And you go, is it? And they go, oh, yes, it's really dangerous. And then you say, well, have you been there? And they go, no. And you go, and then you think, well, how do you know if it's dangerous? And the thing I've learned most about traveling is, and I've been to some strange places, is that people, 99% of people are good, and 99% of people are interested in what you're doing, want to help, you know, and are happy that you're there traveling and exploring their country. And it's a really friendly world. And sadly, often the press, you know, to sensationalize things, don't necessarily portray it like that. And I just sit in wonder every time I go somewhere I sit in wonder of the culture and the food and the people and the humor and the fun that you can have in all these countries. And that's what's really I've learned. So I'm always happy to go anywhere. Still, even when I was acting, you know, ready to go to any country to have an adventure, that still turns me on.
It's very hard to avoid having any prejudices. Are there any examples for when you have been really positively surprised?
Positively or negatively?
Positively, because you said what you learned is that, you know, people, basically, to put it very simply, people are so nice everywhere. And that is something that you know now based on your experience.
Yeah.
Did you always have this knowledge, this feeling, this truth? Or did you also sometimes in the beginning of this whole journey struggle with prejudice that you then were able to confront?
I think when Ewan and I first left, you know, we were really quite nervous about certain countries, you know, and the unknown because of what you hear, you know, and it doesn't matter how much traveled you are, you can read something and somewhere deep down, even though you know it's not true, you could still worry about it. And so I remember when we first got into Eastern Europe and stuff, and you know, we started riding, because everything changes when you cross a border. I mean, everything, you know, we went from Germany to I think it was the Czech Republic. And that's just a line in the sand, and you cross over and everything changes. Architecture, tarmac, the color of the paint on the roads, the signposts, the what people are wearing, and it goes from a very rich, sophisticated country to, at that time, you know, 14, 15 years ago, it was a very poor country. And it was like, wow, you know, and then you felt a bit nervous and thinking, oh my gosh. And then, you know, you start to realize that, you know, that when people are approaching you, they're just approaching you because you look so strange, you know, on a big motorbike with all this BMW gear and all this kind of stuff. And then you start talking to them, and they sort of, the first thing they always say is, oh, where have you come from? And you go such and such. They go, oh, where are you going? And you go, and we used to say to them, oh, we're going to New York. And they go, what? And people just didn't understand what we were. They just don't, what? Why? What? And they would say, why? And you go, well, and, you know, I could never really answer that. I go, well, because I thought it was a good idea.
It's a valid question. Why?
And I'm thinking, I can't answer that question because I hadn't really thought about it. I just thought it'd be a good idea. And then eventually we had to, on the back of our top boxes, we got this sticker company to make up a map of the world with our route on it, you know, so that we could show people, because people just couldn't understand, you know.
Yes.
And you would say, look, we're going here, and they're going along here, and this is where we're going. They'd all go, oh, wow, okay. And then they'd go, how can we help? You know, so it was great. And we got stopped by the police once. They chased us down, these two police cars, and pulled us over. And we were in Ukraine somewhere. We thought, oh, shit, here we go. And they stopped, and one pulled in front, one pulled behind. And we thought, oh, God, here we go. And this time they got out and they were walking towards us, and they thought crime was going. And the guy stopped and he goes, oh, he said, I just wanted to tell you that Chelsea won today in the football. Because he saw the English number plates and he thought that, you know, we'd probably be Chelsea's football supporters. But I don't know anything about football. And I was going, yeah, no, great. Yeah, go Chelsea. You know, I live by there. And that's all they wanted. You know, they just wanted to say, and they're just saying, where are you going? And, oh, right, okay. And, you know, it was just hilarious.
Yes, and as you have already mentioned before, there was so much that resulted from that trip, right? I mean, there was A Long Way Down. That was another show that you did with Ewan from Scotland to South Africa, which, of course, is a completely different part of the world. But
totally different experience, and just crazy, you know, riding along. I mean, Africa is the most incredible place to ride. I think it's one of the best places I've ever ridden.
And how far? Why is that?
Oh, well, because I'll tell you why, because it's the only continent left that has wild animals, really. I mean, Germany and everyone have rabbits and deer, and that's about it, really. And South America has llamas, and so Australia has kangaroos. But Africa, you know, you'd be riding along. I do a motorcycle tour every year in Africa, and we go from Cape Town to Victoria Falls, and we go sort of South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, and all off-road on bikes. It's a fantastic trip. But, you know, when I've been riding along with and taking a bunch of people with me and been riding along, we have to stop because 50 elephants are crossing the road. And you just have to stop and wait. And I'm sitting there thinking, come on, you know, because I've seen it so many times. And I look beside me and there's two or three of the guys riding with me. And I can see their eyes through the helmet. And their eyes are like wide open. And they're looking at it and they're going, and you can see them thinking in their mind, they're thinking, is that 50 elephants? Do we have to stop? And they would shout out, Charlie, how long are we going to be here? And I said, I have no idea. And we sort of sit there and chat away while the elephants go past. And they're going, I can't believe this. And then you'd ride on and you would see giraffe and zebra and eland and kudu and hippos and just everything that you can possibly think of that's in Africa. And they're just walking around wild. And there isn't anywhere left in the world. We've shot everything out around the rest of the world. You know, maybe bears in North America, maybe. But it is pretty crazy place, Africa. Pretty damn crazy place to ride a motorbike. It really is. And Ewan and I just loved it. You know, going through Ethiopia was bonkers. I mean, if you know, you've never seen so many cows in all your life than in Ethiopia. Just extraordinary.
But it's also offering extraordinary opportunities for things to go wrong, right? And
oh, yeah.
Things to get really annoying. And we have talked about it before. Very often these moments actually lead to the greatest moments, or at least the greatest memories of such a trip. Do you have the same impression
definitely.
When you think back to that trip?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there were definitely... I mean, one time we stopped to go camping in the middle of nowhere Anyway, we set up our tents, and you've got to be very careful not to set up on a hippo path and stuff like that. So there are certain key things you have to do, because hippos are creatures of habit. So they come out of the water every night and they walk on the same path every night. And if something is blocking it, they can't get that around their head. So they just go through it. And they're pretty strong, you know, in big things. And so you figure out that you can't sleep there. So we put our tents down. Anyway, we're chatting away, and then Ewan goes to bed in his tent. He goes, Charlie, come here. And we come there, and surrounding his tent are these giant ants, like these giant leafcutter ants, huge things. And there's one big trail, and then the trail cuts off, and it's surrounding his tent. And he's going, they're huge, and they're very dangerous. You know, if they get on top of you, you can really, really, they can be really bad. And he's going, what do I do? What do I do? And we had to get his tent. We had to pick it up, and we had to move it outside the circle of ants. Oh, God. Not that that was terribly dangerous, but it was just funny. You know, these funny things that happen.
Yes.
And all sorts of things happened. We got chased by elephants, and you had to run. I mean, you know, you've got to be so careful when they decide to charge. I mean, those things can run fast, you know. And I remember one charging me, and I thought, well, I'll be okay because there's four or five trees between the elephant and me. And then this elephant started running after me, and it just started knocking these trees down like they were matchsticks, you know. And I had to just run. Because there was noise. And it got spooked. It was a young male, and he was hormonal and you know, full of testosterone, you know.
Yes.
So you got to, there's all these things you got to. Now I know, you know, I can sit there and I can guide people quite happily to tell them where and how, what they should do, like everything through experience of almost being killed. You know, it's kind of something you never forget. And then, you know, crashing is always a good one. Done a lot of that. So.
Yes, of course. And yeah, after that one, of course, there were many, many more projects. You already mentioned the Dakar Rally, but there was
I was very proud of that. I really, that was a tough one. It was hard.
A tough one because you injured yourself pretty early on, unfortunately.
Yeah. I know. I did 5 days, and I was 80th out of 210 bikes. I was doing really well.
Yes.
Anyway, and then I crashed doing about 10 kilometers an hour. And broke my hands. I mean, it was a pathetic crash, really. It was embarrassing.
Both of them.
For days, I couldn't talk about the crash because it was just so slow and so silly. But, that, you know, all those experiences were all because of Long Way Round and just two guys thinking that would be a good idea. And it's lovely. I mean, I can sit here and my kids are in their mid-20s and all have done university, and one's going to be a doctor and one is working in PR for restaurants and chefs. And it's just nice. It's nice to be able to breathe, you know.
How do you choose your projects today? What do they have to offer in order for you to be interested in it?
I just have a list that I made up years ago, and I'm just slowly getting through them.
I don't believe it.
Dakar Rally. Yeah.
Is that true?
No, it's not.
No,
we did Long Way Round, and then we spoke about the Dakar Rally during it and how much I'd love to do it. And I grew up in Ireland. I don't know how popular it is in Germany, but in France and Spain and places, it's almost religious, you know. And in Ireland, where I grew up, it's huge, the Dakar Rally. People watch it. So I grew up watching it. And then I just thought, God, well, look, if this TV show's done really well, maybe I can convince some people to give me some more money. And so I kind of asked around and they said yes. And then, you know, again, got the money and then thought, shit, how am I going to do this?
And that led to By Any Means, probably, right?
Yeah, it was led to Long Way Down and then By Any Means.
Yes, yes.
And then Extreme Frontiers. Yeah. And then some other stuff. And now, you know, I've just finished a big project, which I can't talk about.
Yes, I know. So I'm not asking you, but yeah, we keep it secret for now.
Well, maybe later on this year we can chat about it.
Yeah, that would be amazing. So things changed quite a bit for you in February 2016. You were in Portugal then.
Oh, yeah.
What did you want to do there, and what ended up happening?
I was there. I was an ambassador for Triumph Motorcycles. And I've been doing a bunch of work with them, and I was on we were launching the new Tiger, the Tiger 1200, and we had all the press there, and it was day three of the thing, and I came out of the airport, the hotel, and with some press, and they were in front of me, and we're just coming out of this sort of small town, and I went to overtake this car just coming out of town, and then just as I overtook the car, it decided to turn left and hit me. And then I'm not quite sure what happened, but I just remember myself flying through the air, heading towards a wall, and I clipped the pavement. It was quite a high pavement. I clipped the pavement with my backside, and then I went into the wall with my legs, and I broke them both very badly. And below my left knee, I broke the both bones, and they came out of the skin and all that kind of stuff. And I remember sort of having the crash and trying to stand up and looking down at my leg, and all this blood was coming out, and my leg was just flopping around, you know, halfway down the shin. It was just bending in all the wrong directions, and it was horrible. And so I kind of lay back down thinking, shit, this is not good. And then the guys from Triumph turned up, and then the ambulance turned up, and they had to stop the bleeding, and then they had to make the leg straight because it was all bent in the wrong direction. It was all bending backwards, and there was a lot of blood and all that kind of stuff. And then so they put that straight, and then I said there was a lot of pain in my other leg and my ankle, so they looked at that, and then that my right ankle was badly dislocated and broken. And then as they were fixing all those, I was pointing at my hand saying, is that wrong? There was a big dent. There was a big dent in my hand. And I said, is that a problem? And they went, oh, shit, that's a problem as well. So I managed to break both legs and my hand.
Oh, my God.
And they sent me off to hospital. they weren't sure whether or not my leg I could keep my leg, because it was so badly broken, and only the muscle was holding it on. And so I went through all of that, and then I had the operation. And I woke up the next morning, and I woke up afterwards, the operation, my wife was there. She'd flown down because I did it in the morning. She was there in the afternoon. I had to wait all day on a stretcher all day waiting for the surgeons, because it was so complicated, the operation, that they had to take time to figure out what to do. And anyways, and I remember lying, waking up in the morning and thinking, looking at myself, and both my legs were not working. My right hand wasn't working. I just had my left hand. And I was thinking, oh, what have I done? You know, I really, really, what have I done? it was awful. And I was feeling really sorry for myself. I thought, shit, this is bad. And I thought this was really bad. And I was thinking, you know, what am I going to do? And anyway, so I looked to my right and there was a guy lying in the bed beside me, and he wasn't in a great shape. And I looked at him and I looked at myself and I thought, actually, mine aren't too bad. You know, it's not so bad. And so I became quite cheery after that. I thought, okay, that's all right. I can deal with this. Little did I know that fucking 2.5 years later, I was still trying to work, and 14 operations later. And
so how are you today?
Today, pretty good, actually. I'm walking around and you know, riding motorbikes, and just did this big project, and I'm good. I can't run anymore. I can't ski, and my knees are very bad. But I think the knees are bad partly from the crash, but partly because I used to do a lot of motocross and training for the Dakar Rally and all that kind of stuff. I seem to really have smashed my knees up. So mostly my own fault, really. But I do remember, you know, the when you recover from something like this. I mean, I was in bed for 5 months, and then I was in a wheelchair for 4 months, and I had big rehabilitation and physiotherapy and all this kind of stuff. But one of the greatest moments that I had, and of realizing that I was getting better, was when I was in my wheelchair and I finally just thought, I could go to the toilet, you know, because at this point I was always going to the toilet in my bed, you know, with a bedpan. I don't know what you call that in German.
Yes,
in German. And with the bedpan, it was horrible, you know. And so I worked out that if I could get on and off my wheelchair by myself. So if I went to the beginning of the staircase to go upstairs, I could put myself on the bottom two steps, and then I could go down, and then I could shuffle along on my bottom to underneath the stairs where the toilet was, and I could put my legs in first, and then I could sort of stand up, pull my trousers down, swing round and sit on the toilet, and I could go to the toilet. And this was my big plan. So I was going along and got my legs in, and I stood up and I could get my trousers down. And the big thing was to swing round and to sit on the toilet. And I swung round and I missed the toilet. And it was a very small toilet, and I missed the toilet, and I got stuck between the wall and the toilet.
No.
And I was stuck with my legs sticking out, and I was all squashed up against the side of the wall, you know, sitting on the floor between the toilet and me, and I couldn't move. And I was stuck with my trousers down by my ankles. And my daughter, Dune, walked past. She was holding a computer, walking past, and she looked at me, and she just said, "Dad, what the fuck are you doing down there?" And I said, "Oh, I missed the toilet." I said, "Can you give me a hand?" And she said, "Nope," and just walked off. And I had to drag myself out, and I finally got onto the toilet, and I finally sat there, and I just remember thinking, "I am on the way to recovery.
I'm back.
Yeah, I'm back." And I cannot tell you how good that first use of the toilet was. It was just amazing.
A great, great symbol of freedom, I guess.
Oh my gosh, yes. And then I realized I was, you know, I was close to getting back on the bikes. And eventually my right leg got better. I still had this big cage around my left leg, you know, like a big frame on the outside of the leg holding it together. And then I realized I could ride my wife's scooter with it. So I used to take the Vespa out without my family knowing that I was riding.
But that was not completely successful as well, as far as
no, that wasn't successful. I remember, yeah, doing more injury. I fell off and thought I'd broken my 50th birthday. When I just turned 50, and I fell off the scooter, almost standing still, and I fell on my hip, and then the bike fell on my cage. And all the wires going through my leg all started bleeding, and my hip, I couldn't do anything. We had to call an ambulance, and I got up and sat on a stool and told the ambulance that I was, you know, I'd fallen off my stool fixing the bike. And the ambulance driver looked at me and he said, "Charlie, we know who you are. And that just doesn't sound right. And it was like, okay, I fell off the scooter. Anyway, we went to the hospital, and I remember them sitting there, and I was sitting there, and you know, it was like, oh, are you back again? And the guy introduced me, and he said, this is a, you know, it's a male, suspected broken hip, 50. And I just felt old, because that's what happens to old people.
Yes.
You know, they fall over and they break their hip, you know. And there I was at 50 with what I thought was a broken hip. Oh, it's awful. Anyway, and there's been a few more crashes since then, but I can't talk about those. So
you almost drowned on a boat once. We didn't go into it, but it happened while filming By Any Means, the TV show. Yeah. It happened on a boat on the way to Australia. So you died on that almost, and used boats again after that. You almost died on a motorbike and drive motorbikes again. My question is, what would need to happen in order for you to change or even stop your travels?
My wife keeps asking the same thing. She keeps saying, Charlie, don't you think, I mean, I don't mind you riding motorbikes, but shouldn't you change the way you ride motorbikes?
Exactly.
Shouldn't you take a little bit more care or something like that? I think I'm too old to learn new tricks. So I think I'll just carry on. I don't know. I think I'm a little bit more careful now. I mean, on boats, I'm a little bit more careful about what boat I get on. Because boats, you can really, really mess up on boats. And there really is no, you know, there is no, when it gets wrong, you can't see land and things go wrong. It's, you know, it's dangerous.
And, and back then it did go pretty wrong, right?
Yeah, no, things went bad. We were on a speedboat trying to get across a bay to catch a train. And the guy didn't know what he was doing. We ended up at this huge wave went over our boat and killed the boat. And then we started drifting towards these cliffs, and we had other people on the boat, and only three of us out of eight people could swim, and there were like two life jackets, and oh, it was just a nightmare. And so we managed to get rescued with that, so we got away with that. And then on later on that same trip, I went from Timor to Darwin. It was supposed to take 3 days, and it took 6.5 days, and we spent 3.5 days or so in a storm that were 11 to 15 meter swell for 3.5 days, day and night. And we're on this tiny boat in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, the captain wasn't very happy. And, you know, none of us were very happy. Oh my God. That was just awful, awful. I remember looking at the compass, you know, at the GPS. I was looking at the GPS, and we were doing 1 knot an hour, which is not very fast. And we were 250 miles, so 370 kilometers from anywhere. And I just thought, you know, and I remember making a video to my wife and putting the rushes of the TV show that we'd filmed into a watertight bag and into a big box so that, you know, when they found the bits and pieces of the boat, they would find this message to my wife. And the rushes, so they could finish the movie. You know?
Of course, to immortalize you.
Yeah, yeah. But it's all, you know, it's all fun. It's all the bits you remember and laugh about, you know.
Yes.
And it's all good adventure. It's all good fun.
I would like to have a little bit of more fun for 2 more minutes by having a little lightning round of questions to close up or to finish up. Doesn't necessarily mean that your answer needs to be absolutely short, but my question will be rather short.
Okay.
I was happiest while traveling in
Africa.
One of the probably most dangerous situations I got myself into while traveling.
Well, I think my little boat stories were pretty dodgy, but I do remember one when Ewan and I were in Eastern Europe somewhere, and we were stopped, and it was our first wild camel that we'd seen, and we were messing around filming it, and suddenly this little white larder pulled up, and this big guy got out of the driver's seat and started walking towards us and looking at our cameras and equipment. And then we looked in on the back seat, and there was this guy had rolled the window down, and he pulled a gun out and he pointed it at Ewan and I, and he had these smiled with these gold teeth.
Wow.
And he was about to say something, and this big truck came by and slowed down, and they got back in the car and drove off. And I must say, for a moment, Ewan turned around to me and he said, you know, Charlie, I thought I was dead then. So, yes, that springs to mind.
the essence of what traveling gives to me?
I think faith in humanity and that nearly every country in the world is just fabulous, and the people in it are just wonderful. It's usually just a very small percentage of the people that fuck it up for everybody else.
Normally the ones with gold teeth.
Normally the ones with gold teeth, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Living.
And the ones with big titles. You know, the bigger the title, the bigger of a wanker the guy is.
Living a good, intense life means to me.
My father is very old. He's 87 years old, and you know, he can't really walk very well. His mind is perfect. And he said that living a long old life is punishment for living a good, healthy life. So we have all that to look after. So, you know, yeah, there you go.
My definition of an adventure is
riding motorbikes in any country I could find.
A common misconception about long-distance motorbike trips is?
Yeah, the idea of with friends and stuff, and we're going to go to the country, and they go, yeah, but that's like 150 kilometers away. I mean, that's a long way. I always laugh. I said, 150, when I get to 150 kilometers, I think I'm almost at the destination. So that's my idea of distance. You know, my idea of distance is totally different to most other people's.
I consider my greatest success so far to be?
Well, I would have to say, because my wife is looking at me right now, I'd have to say that it was my marriage to my wife and my two girls. but now she's gone away. She's not listening. It's all the motorbikes that I've bought. And my saddest moments are the ones I had to sell.
How many do you have?
If I tell you that and she listens to this, I'm in huge trouble. But
she never counted them.
She doesn't actually really care, to be honest. But I have quite a few. So yeah, I have a problem with that.
Okay, last one, an open one. When I think about the future,
you and I, you know, whenever you do a big journey, one of the hardest things is to stop and go back to reality and not moving every day and experiencing different things and being on the open road. And so we often talk about what we're going to do next and stuff like that. And you know, when Yoon and I finished Long Way Down, you know, we were always talking about, you know, that we would do a third one or that we would do something else. And I think partly, the reason you talk about that is so that you can put it in your mind that, okay, I'm going to finish this one, but I've got another one coming. So it makes it easier to finish the one you're on, knowing that you'll do another one. So I suppose it's that, really.
Very nice, Charlie. I thank you very much for taking the time to give us a glimpse into your background, your history of adventure, a lifetime of adventure.
Yeah, I've got another 20 years of it yet, you know, yes. I hope.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm looking forward to seeing which kind of show and program or book you come up with next. I will definitely join in and read it.
Well, listen, let's make a deal that, you know, whenever the next one comes out, let's talk again.
That would be my absolute pleasure. I will take you at your word. I will get back to you because I already know what's going to happen. So I'm interested. I'm in.
Okay. Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure to meet you on the cyber world. And thank you, everybody, whoever's there listening. Thank you very much. And maybe see some of you down the road somewhere.
Great. Thanks a lot. And talk to you soon in a few months, I guess. Thank you so much.
Right. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That was my conversation with Charlie Borman. I hope you liked this episode of Unfolding Maps. If you did, and if you want to support the show, I would be thrilled if you would take the time to rate and review it on the Apple Podcast app and potentially follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date with new guests and some behind-the-scenes material. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hey. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.